Thank you. I wasn't sure if it was just part of the liturgy to have to start talking and then forget that you're muted. So I'm breaking with the liturgy there. Thank you again for the opportunity to share something with you. I think last time I saw many of you was back in the beginning of March. I think if I remember correctly, I told you that I was giving up church for Lent as my least edifying practice, my least edifying habit. Well, little did I know that the whole world would be giving up church for Lent as we entered into the longest March. I am, you'd be glad to know, or maybe glad to know that I am going back to church now. But yeah, it is, it's a pleasure to, I think this bunch of people is amazing, I have to say. I love that I have freedom to roam a little bit with my thoughts in terms of what I can share with you. And I think that is all about all of you and the open-heartedness that I've experienced from you. So I just wanted to honor you with that. Okay, what else did I want to say just at the beginning here? Well, you know how we have traditionally also had a children's moment, a children's story. Well, I'm going to start with a children's story, even though too many really children here. I just see children of all ages. I'm going to tell you Nana Bourgeois' story. Excellent. Well, from when I first heard the story, I was quite fascinated by the Prometheus story about stealing fire. He is this demigod sort of character that stole fire from Zeus and ended up in the Greek, at least the Greek version of the story, he brings fire to some poor, huddling, cold human beings, and with the advent of fire, bringing fire to people's kind of civilization is born, and you know people begin to get creative, and they, you know, they engage in agriculture and business and everything, and they start prospering as a result of fire. But in the Greek version of that story from Hesiod's the very, very early collection of myths, Zeus is not very happy about this. And so as punishment, Prometheus gets chained to a rock and gets his liver pecked out every day. So he has to face the perpetual punishment of having his liver taken out by an eagle. So it's really not a very happy ending, at least Hesiod's version. There's another version that comes up with Aeschylus later on, where he eventually gets unchained. I think that one's called Prometheus Bound. And then so the Greek version of that story, he is the kind of tragic hero. He's the classic tragic hero, right? So he's doing this thing out of care and concern for the poor benighted human race, and he pays the price for it from the gods. The Olympian gods are not going to let him get away with that. But he's still a hero in the Greek version. There's another Latin version where he's seen as being like almost like a scoundrel. That's, you know, he's not the tragic hero, but he's like, he doesn't know his place and that. So like they're kind of varying shades of narrative there. There's also, you might be interested to know that there's also a Vedic one from the ancient Hindu Vedas. I won't tell you that one, but it was a companion of Agni, the fire deity. But what is absolutely fascinating about this story is that it is found in three corners of the world. So you've got your ancient Near East, which we all know. And then you've got India, right, from the ancient Vedas. And then there's also a Nana Bajou version of the story, which is what I want to tell you today. And personally, I like the Nana Bajou version best. And I hope you can see why. Okay, so on a particularly cold and bitter day, Nana Bajou went to his grandmother Nokomis's wigwam. Everything around him was frozen, so he stamped his feet and briskly rubbed his hands together to warm himself. He complained about the temperature to Nokomis and asked if there was any way to be warmer. She told him about fire, which would keep people cozy when it's cold. She said that once, a very long time before, fire was available to everyone as long as they kept it fed with birch bark, twigs, and sticks. On that picture, you can see is a Norval Morisseau painting of Nana Bajou. And as you might know, Nana Bajou is a shapeshifter, so he takes on different forms. Well, talk of fire sparked Nana Bajou's interest, and he asked Nokomis where he could find it. She told him that he could not acquire it because an old man and his two daughters kept it carefully guarded. Despite warning Nana Bajou about the danger of taking fire from the old man, he would not be deterred. He was determined to take the fire, and so he left his grandmother's home. He went to the edge of a large lake, wrapped his rabbit skin robe tightly around his body, and set off in his canoe to find the old man, his daughters, and the fire. While he traveled, Nana Bajou grew colder and colder and wrapped his robe tighter and tighter around himself. He finally arrived at the old man's wigwam. Quickly, he turned into a rabbit and jumped into the frozen lake just before one of the old man's daughters came to draw water. Seeing the poor shivering rabbit, the young woman fished him out and brought him inside. Her sister was very worried that the old man would awaken and be angry that the rabbit was in their home. But her sister laughed at these concerns. Placing Nana Bajou, who appeared as a rabbit, next to the fire to dry, the two sisters continued their work. The old man suddenly sat up and asked who had come into his wigwam while he was sleeping. The girls showed him Nana Bajou and told him not to worry. It was just a rabbit, after all. Grumbling, the old man returned to his mat, but told the girls to be wary of the Manitous, who could take the voice and shape of any animal. When Nana Bajou was finally dry, he sidled up to the fire pit and contemplated how to take a tongue of flame home. Deciding on a course of action, Nana Bajou quickly grabbed an ember from the fire pit and threw it on his back. He ran as fast as he could to his canoe, with the two young women running, crying, and screaming at him to stop. But neither girl was angrier than the old man, however, who had warned him about the rabbit. With his back engulfed in flames, Nana Bajou raced back to his grandmother's home. Nearing the wigwam, Nana Bajou yelled at her to prepare for the fire. As he sprinted towards her, Nokomis scooped the ember off Nana Bajou and into the kindling she had prepared. The burning on Nana Bajou's back did not stop when Nokomis removed the ember. He begged her to heal him because he had been badly burnt. She laughed, called him a fool, and turned away. Nana Bajou became quite angry and demanded that she help him. Finally, Nokomis reminded Nana Bajou that the rabbit shape he wore was not his own, and that if he would only change back into a man, he'd no longer be hurt. Realizing his mistake, Nana Bajou shucked the rabbit skin and stood once more as a man, proud that he'd brought fire back to his people. The burn mark on his rabbit skin can be seen to this day. So these pictures that I've had along the way in this story are combination of Norval Morisseau's pictures and then also a artist from the region called Jim Oskunigish. And then this picture here is a pictograph of Nana Bajou as a rabbit. And he's frequently known to take the shape of a rabbit. So Natabuju, as you know, is this trickster. He's a hero. He is somewhat of a tragic hero, but he is much more of a trickster in the Anishinaabe stories of him. And I love that, the ending of this story, because rather than getting his liver pecked out for all eternity, he just had to be reminded that actually his rabbit skin was not really, it was just a persona. And he could easily, just as easily take it off as he put it on. So all's well that ends well. And if you think about it, the old man and his daughters, they still had their fire, but now the fire was shared with everybody else here. So I love this story. And I hope that you can understand why I much prefer the Nanabajou version of this story to the brutality of the Greek myth. But I wanted to use this as a little bit of a kind of a launching pad for telling you my story with the job that I've been in for the last few years. So when I first came back from India, I had a freshly minted doctorate in comparative theology. And what I'd really wanted to do was teach at, just get a nice cushy academic job and teach my subject. And, you know, and I thought, well, how hard should that be, right? But then, as I said in the introduction, my daughters wanted to have a Canadian education. They'd grown up in India. So I didn't think it was too much to ask when they said they'd like to be in Thunder Bay for their high school years. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to have to get creative about work then, because there really isn't much of a religious studies program of which to speak at LU. So this opportunity came my way from Nokiwin to do a needs assessment report for them back in 2016. And it was specifically for the disabilities initiative of Nokiwin, and it was to look to do interviews and also some book research, lit review sort of work, as well as talking to service providers in the communities to find out what the needs are, who the service providers are, and what sort of direction the communities would like to take this in. So I've stripped out all the data here because I'm not allowed to show you that. But as you can see, my report was filled with all kinds of graphs and charts and, you know, pie charts and everything. It looks very impressive. And I used big words like decolonization and everything. And, you know, it's all this kind of academic sort of talk. Well, this is a direct quote from one of the elders from Fort William First Nation. She says, "This sounds like biomedical blah blah," and so she herself uses the big word, but then she very much like Nokomis from the story. She just laughs at poor Nanabuju and says, "Ugh, come on, get over yourself," and so. This was my beginning point with working with the tribal council, Nokiwin Tribal Council. And from this, I kept getting more contracts with them. Initially, I was just a contract worker and mainly doing research because I'd just come from a research background. So where did that take me next? Well, this got me asking, okay, so if the biomedical model is just biomedical blah blah, and it doesn't really touch on the deeper needs, then how do we get to that? Where do we go with this? So the next research contract that I got with Nokiwin was to do a web mapping of services. But it wasn't going to be just for service providers. It was going to be looking at all services. And that means all, I had to start looking at all quadrants of the medicine wheel, right? So the biomedical model just looks, it will look at physical for sure, touch on mental, touch on emotional, but has very little to say about the spiritual, right? And in fact, might even be denigrating of the spiritual and might even be in total denial of the spiritual, right? Certain versions of the biomedical model want nothing to do with the spiritual. And yet, as all of us here know, it is absolutely essential to our wellness, to our well-being. And there's a reason why in the Anishinaabe version of the medicine wheel, it's placed in the East, because it's the very start of all journeys, right? The very start of all journeys is the spiritual. And it's also the true nature and state of infancy, of actual childhood, right? There's a reason why children are born with this kind of intuitive sense of things, right? But we forget things and we get layered over. We get layered over with rabbit skin personas, right? And so we tend to forget who we are. And that's exactly what happened to Nana Buju. But and you probably have heard people teach on the medicine wheel that it begins in infancy, then goes to childhood, then goes to adulthood, and then finally to eldership, right? So there's a whole, in addition to the cardinal directions of the compass, there's also a movement through a whole lifetime, right? It's the story of the journey from infancy to elder, to being an elder, and then back again. And you can see how closely elders touch on being infants again. There's a childlikeness about eldership, right? Which is really quite lovely. Then of course, all the medicines that go along with that, right? So you got your tobacco, your sage, your cedar, your sweetgrass. I'm not going to get into all this because it's not my teaching, but I've had the privilege of having elders teach this, you know, to being able to sit and hear elders teach this. And it opened things up for me. This opened things up beautifully in a way that's changed me, right? And so I've moved away from the biomedical blah, blah of trying to impress everybody with my research prowess. And out of this whole thing, I was part of creating what we call our community resource guide, where we did research in all the communities to look at what are the actual supports in all four of these quadrants, right? And how do people find them? So rather than having to, you know, just Google search, they can go to the community resource guide and say, what's available in Picmobert? What's available nearby to Picmobert? What's available in Rocky Bay? Right. So that came out of the second round of research. Then I got hired on, which was even better. And one of the things that I was asked to do was to, out of that kind of research, learning a new way of researching, to develop what Nokiwans called a community-based research toolkit. Now, I really wish I could show you the research framework that we came up with, but again, I'm not allowed to share that with you, but it's beautiful. It is so beautiful. So we had this, we called for a research workshop. And to do that, we invited people from all five of the communities that we serve and work with, and from all different departments within those communities, and a range of ages from young people all the way up to elders. And then we invited academics from Lakehead University. Some of them were Indigenous scholars, some of them were non-Indigenous scholars. And we just had a whole day together to dream about what community-based research would look like. And that same elder, Marlene Pierre, who has this beautiful knack of cutting through the crap. She had this moment in the very first opening session we had one of the academics there. One of the academics talked about, he was using words like pedagogy and epistemology. That was the word. So one of the academics used the word epistemology, and she, Marlene Pierre, did her just blah blah stuff again. What does that mean? What does that even mean? So when I got the chance to speak, I spoke directly to Marlene and thanked her for that moment, because everybody needs that moment in all of our meetings when we forget our personas, we forget what dialect of English we're speaking. And I said, so Marlene, when you have your grandchild first ask you why, you know, where does the wind come from? Or why is the fire hot? Or why do we do this particular thing in a ceremony? What that child is becoming is a researcher. So that child, that three-year-old child, is a researcher, because he or she is asking the how, the who, what, where, when, why, and how questions, right? So it was this moment of stealing fire from academia, bringing it back on a community level, and bringing it back to the very youngest among us, right? That children should be researchers, right? So what should community-based research look like? It should flow out of the questions of real people in real communities, right? This is not just some curiosity and oddity of or a particular obsession of an academic, right? And therefore that academic owns all that material. No. This should be born of questions and needs that emerge from the community itself. And then the research belongs to the community as well. It doesn't belong to the academic, right? It comes back to the community. So we dreamed about this, what community-based research would look like. And the other thing that I said to Marlene was, when your grandchild comes to you in particular, why you? Because you're an elder, because you have an authority. That's what epistemology is all about. Epistemology is your sources of knowledge. How do you come to know things? How do you come to know? So just to steal fire from these big academic words and bring it to a place where people can, oh, okay, that makes sense. So when every time an elder is consulted, they're consulted because they are authority. That's an appeal to authority. That's a legitimate and valid form of epistemology, a way of knowing things, right? As I said, I wish I could show you the research framework that we came up with, because it's absolutely beautiful. But what this is now is, now this is our protocol, right? So when we have industry, right? When there's mines, when there's logging, when there's academics, people want to come into the region, right? And into the homelands of the five First Nation communities that we work with. We can give this as protocol to them and say, okay, but this is what you have to abide by, right? And then once you can, if you can agree to abiding by this, then we can begin relationship, right? And it relocated research. It's such a privilege to be part of this. One of the highlights for me of that workshop, and it's in our toolkit here, is one of the communities, Picmobert, they recognized that part of the colonial legacy was they had their community bundle stolen from them. They had it, their community bundle was definitely by colonial design, because if you remove the bundle, you remove the very heart of the community. And so what Picmobert did is they were on a several year process of rebuilding their community bundle. And they did that as a whole community. So they actually have a physical bundle again as a result of this process. And she shared that process with us in this research framework workshop. And it was like, yeah, we heard from great academics and everything, but honestly, hers was the highlight of the day for me. right? Because it was the story of the relocation of research back to the communities. The other thing that came out of it was that and there's actually a book by this title, Research is Ceremony. Ceremony is a form of research, right? So all of those fasting ceremonies, sweat lodge ceremonies, they're all a form of research, right? So it was that stealing fire from academics. And maybe one day, one-on-one, I'll be able to show you the framework that we came up with. It is just gorgeous. Last year, here I am in this new role. Last year I was working as the disabilities coordinator. And one of the things that kept coming up was that the actual caregivers in the communities aren't necessarily parents. They're usually aunties and grandmas, right? And super grandmas, because the grandmas are those who are holding families together. They're the ones who are holding communities together. They're the glue, right? And so I really do think of them as being heroes, right? They're the ones that are preventing children from going into the system, from getting lost in foster care, right? And they're the ones who are, when there's trouble in a home, when children aren't being cared for, they're the ones who step in, though they don't have very much resources of their own, that will say, I will take care of that grandchild. And not only that, but I will take care of a friend's grandchild as well, right? So you've got certain grandmothers, and these are the super grandmas, who are caring not only for their own biological grandchildren, but also other people's grandchildren, right? Because they're in a place where they can do this, right? Where often there are missing parents. Parents are going through, whatever it is, rehab, or they're, some that I know are in the, they're in jail, or they've just moved, right? Because they couldn't cope, And this too is the legacy of colonialism and, of course, of the residential school system. Even though those parents didn't go through residential school, they are the result of parenting that, it was a direct correlation to this. But now, so we held an elders gathering, and this is going back now to January of 2020, so the beginning of this year, we held an elders gathering for elders from all five of the communities. And it was to hear their stories and to hear their stories about intergenerational care. How do communities care for people with disabilities? How did intergenerational care happen, right? So who cares for the elders? Who cares for those ones that are the super grandmas, right? Do they get care? And we had 3 days of hearing they were just beautiful people sharing their heart, and some of it was very sad. Some of it, the justice rose up in me, and the anger rises up at the injustice of things. But there's this lightness and humor about it as well. So just like Nokomis from that stealing fire, the Nana Bajou stealing fire story. Oh, she just laughs at Nana Bajou for being a fool, right? And reminds him of who he is and reminds him that he's forgotten himself, right? And that, I've seen that so many times. I've seen that happen so many times in First Nations context, but also especially among elders. There's this delight and this twinkle, even though they've been through some terrible stuff. And, they have survived just the worst kinds of injustices. And yet there's this humor about them. There's this delight that they have in being able to talk to young people as well. And it just makes me so happy. So from that job, working as a disabilities coordinator, I kept getting a lot of requests to write what are called Jordan's principle applications. Principle is a big, big government funding pot for children, for First Nations children, and all First Nations, any First Nations children up to the 18th birthday. And so I was putting in applications on behalf of grandmas and aunties, right, to for tutoring, for special medical needs, for respite care, you name it, psych ed reports and assessments, you name it. And I was getting more and more of these Jordan's Principle requests. So I put in an application to create a new position at Nokiwin, just someone who would be like a service coordinator just for Jordan's Principle. I was approved. My new job. Go figure. So my new job now, Jordan's Principle service coordinator for Nokiwin, for the 5 Nokiwin communities. And can I tell you, it is the best job I've ever had. And I mean that in all sincerity, because, man, I get to talk to such amazing and fascinating people, all different generations, and everybody's story is so different. The needs, many of the needs are the same, right? Very similar needs. But what I get to do is I get to talk to those very precious caregivers, and they trust me with their story, right? And then with that trust, I turn that into an application. So I talk to the grandma in a way, like I mirror her language, right? To be able to talk, you know, so that we understand each other fully and completely. I promise you, I don't use words like epistemology. And when I get, when I, and when she or whoever the caregiver is entrusts me with their story, I turn that into a support letter for them. And then I make a case using government language to steal fire from the government to get resources for those children and those families. And can I tell you how much fun that is? It is so much fun stealing fire from government coffers. And I shouldn't say, like, I'm not actually stealing, obviously, but so far to date, and I'm not, and you know what? I'm not saying this just to toot my own horn, because this is totally the grace of God. I have been able to, through applications that I've put in, group applications for respite care, and now a most recent one, I put in a group application for, because there's so many children falling behind now in school, I put in a group application for online tutoring, so we can pay tutors, and specifically, we're recruiting from university and college age Indigenous students, and some of them belong to the communities themselves, we hire them as tutors, $30 an hour. So this is like, you know, we pay a good wage for people to do this. And the hope is that as things open up after COVID, this could become like a big brother, big sister kind of mentoring program, right? And it's a way for college age Indigenous students to give back to their communities. And it's a way to get, so we can pay elders to be able to tell stories to young people. And so there's like after school clubs, there's evening homework sessions, there's special one-on-one tutoring that we have on the weekends. And all of this was from an Jordan's Principle applications that I put in. And then in addition to that, all of the individual applications that I put in for people. And when I say, I don't mean to toot my own horn, but I've, through these applications, pulled in $3 million for the communities. $3 million, that's a lot of money from the government that they've just said, yes, 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 approved. And for me, it's such a delight to be able to steal fire from people. But I want to flip that script even more. So this word here, Wid-ka-ga-manak, that word was given to me by one of the elders from Rocky Bay. His name is Jimmy Mishkwart. And Jimmy Mishkwart is a knowledge holder, he's an elder, and he's a language speaker. So I asked him, and when you ask an elder a question like this, you give an offering of tobacco, right? Just something small, but it's a way of showing honor. And I asked him, so what is the Ojibwe word for family, right? For you know, like something that would be as close to the English word family. And he said, you know what? There is no Ojibwe word for nuclear family. That's not a thing. So he said, you know, and I remember a time when I asked my dad this. And so he asked his dad what the word family was. And his dad said, you know what? I'm going to have to think about that and I'll get back to you. So it was such a puzzle to his dad, this question. And when his dad came back to him, he said, this is the word, all who are within your circle. And I absolutely love that word. I absolutely love that word because what it means is that it extends. It is something beyond the simple and single nuclear family model where everybody's in their own home and that. No. That grandma who's taking care of not only her own grandkids, but also everyone else's grandkids as well, that's her circle, right? And, you know, it is such a delight to be part of this. I want to read you a little text. So this is a mom. We got some funding for beds for her kids because her kids were sleeping on hand-me-down mattresses, right? And so we got funding for furniture for her kids. And so I said, I'll leave out the names. I said, so T, how do the kids like their beds? And this is after. So I'm not thinking about her as a client that, okay, now that you got your money, see you later, right? So she says, kids highly approve of their beds, smiley face. So glad to hear, I said. They both fell asleep right away, lol. Gorgeous ones, I'm happy they're happy. And then she said, M absolutely loves her bedding because we got her Frozen bedding. She loves Frozen, you know, that movie. She absolutely loves her bedding. And then G says, now he's a man too. Because we got him a bigger bed, right? He was just sleeping on a little baby bed. But these are the sorts of texts that I get from, and like, there's no reason why, you know, from an institutional side of things that I should be continuing to text, you know, these caregivers. But other than I'm part of that circle now, all who are within your circle, I am part of her circle. And she just wants to share that G thinks he's a big man now that he's in a big bed. You know, and then she just texted me last week and said, hey, I my full driver's license, you know, this is the mom. And I said, I'm proud of you. I knew you could do it. I never doubted you. And she sent back, lol, you know, so I know you can hear it in what I'm saying, that I get emotional. I talk about this, but I'm very content. I'm very happy to be doing what I'm doing. And it's been a long time. It's been a long time. I went through years of being very unhappy. And also not, and I can relate to Nana Bajou with his burnt rabbit skin, going, now what? This hurts, right? Because going through the ordeal hurts you, right? And I've been through ordeals, my own ordeals. We've all been through our ordeals, right? And I think the acknowledgement of the fact that we all have our ordeals helps us to be non-judgmental of other people when they're talking about their ordeals. But I can relate to Nana Bajou, who's forgotten that actually it's a simple matter of taking that persona off. Just take that persona off and you'll remember who you are. Right? So I found that these last 4 years has helped me to flip my own script and to go from being, you know, this thinking of myself as being this tragic hero that's going to steal fire for people, to actually being someone who is also in need of healing. And that healing coming from the very people that I'm trying to help, right? And the recognition that actually I need what they have. I need the total wellness of the medicine wheel. And the last thing that I wanted to share is, so I do have family members that still, they kind of remind me of the places that I've come from. They remind me of culture that I've come from. And so, like, I have family members still to this day who, when, you know, they ask me about what I'm doing, or whenever the conversation comes up, they'll say, oh, well, you're just so, that's all taxpayers' money. And they're just, you know, those are, you're just people just getting a handout. And, you know, and, you know, I've heard that so much. And I've learned now how to flip the script. And that's this. So I love that in the beginning, that very first, in the opening of our service, we had the land acknowledgement. There was also the acknowledgement that we are all treaty people. And I think that's what this means, right? We are all treaty people. It's a reminder that there was a deal made with Canada, right? A deal that Canada has not made good on, that has consistently broken. And so you've probably heard about the Robinson, Superior, and Huron annuity case that's ongoing. It's been going on for several years now. In a nutshell, it's that when the treaties were first signed, the promise was for an annuity of £1 per year per person who were part of the signatories to the treaty. And so but there was what's called an augmentation clause in it. And the augmentation clause meant that as resources came in from the lands, from the waterways, from the forests, you know, minerals and everything, as revenue came in to the government's coffers, that the annuity would have to be augmented, right? So Canada stayed true to its word for about 20 years. So if that even, so back 1850 was when this was signed. I think by 1874, they froze the annuity at $4. So it's been, the annuity for Robinson, Superior, and Huron has been at $4 since 1874, if I remember my dates correctly, right? And to this day, it's $4. So, you know, people can collect their $4 check, right? Which of course bought a lot of provisions back in 1874, but now it's a Timmy's coffee and a donut, right? So there are a lot of people who collect it just as a joke. There are a lot of people who don't collect it as a protest, right? And what Mike Restoul, in being the lead plaintiff for this, has done is he has reminded Canada of this. Our people have been subsidizing Canada since it became a country, and the British Crown long before that. The British and French monarchies grew rich from the extraction of resources from our territories, from the fur trade to modern mining and forest industries of today. And he's right about this. Untold trillions of dollars have been gained from our lands. We continue to subsidize Canada today while our communities suffer in poverty. We are all treaty people. That's true. That is true. And so this is now my answer to those relatives, right? When those relatives tell me that they're getting a handout and, you know, that's taxpayers' money and all that kind of nonsense, I remind them of this, right? And this, it's not about then me stealing fire. I even want to lay that down. I just use that as a springboard. It's not about me stealing fire. I'm not stealing anything. All I'm doing is I'm telling the government that you've made promises, and it's time now to keep them. So it has been an honor to continue to work in and for the five communities of our tribal council. And I have to say, I have been so welcomed as a Jaganash, as a settler, as a white person. And I've never once been discriminated against. Never. I've been joked with, and you know that people are joking, just like Nokomis, just like Nana Bajou's Nokomis, right? People love to joke, and you learn to join in, right? And you learn to take it, roll with the punches and all of that. But I just wanted to share that with you, because I think I've shared with you before how much I've learned so I still call myself a Christian, very much so. I'm a disciple of Jesus. And that's where those readings there were from, Proverbs and Psalms. That's still very much my worldview. I try to be true to that. But I think I've shared with you before on other occasions how much I've learned from Buddhism and from Hinduism, right? Probably on a number of occasions too. But I really wanted to share with you just how much has been gifted to me from working in an Indigenous context and from Anishinaabe worldview. They call me the Wishnabe at Nokiwan Tribal Council, and I don't mind that, because I do feel that very much so. So thank you very much for listening to my story, and I'm going to stop sharing right now.